Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. It is a cool, breezy evening. About 5 o'clock, it's supposed to rain for just about an hour. So we are definitely in a window of safety here, hopefully. I got all my towels ready just in case this place goes nuts. But as we bring season 4 to a close, as I redo the season 1 episodes, I realize that some of them in there have some great subjects. I think they're covered fairly well, but it's just a little hard to listen to somebody with a microphone a couple inches from your face. And I gained that habit from doing the radio show and then took a year to lose it, basically. So screenwriting is a really big deal to me. Obviously, I do it routinely. And I just feel like I've done about 4 episodes on it. Those that are into it understand its quality. And I own probably almost 24 books of pretty much the top folks that do it. In my opinion, there's really only one guy who's the top, which is Robert McKee, M-C-K-E-E. He wrote a book called Story. I always recommend it because I'm going to give you a little bit of what he says, but by no means am I replacing his stuff. I'm just touching absolutely a fraction, without exaggeration, of his book. I say get it on audio because he reads it to you. He personally reads it to you, and he's got just an amazing stage presence when he's doing anything. But I think that my techniques have refined considerably since 2015 when I first put together, I think it's episode 7. Because there's some folks that, they'll do everything and read books, and that's the only thing that they are willing to do. They never develop any of their own techniques. So if they weren't taught, they don't know. And then so they'll steal it from somebody or borrow from somebody. And screenwriting is a very weird thing. I'm going to tell you a little inside secret. If you want to know why most of your movies suck, it's because anybody who gets involved in it becomes a coveting asshole. And I'm just going to say it like that. They will block you from knowing anything, block you from meeting anyone, never fucking introduce you to the right people. They want this to be their game and their game only. And then the sad part is that Hollywood then has to choose from these assholes in order to make great films. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about everybody, but I'm talking about a lot of people that are well known for what they do. They simply don't want to help you out. Now, part of it is if you keep coming to them for them to write your movie and you're going to give them like a credit, but they're going to write the whole film. That's half the reason why some of these people are jerk-offs, because they're like, it's horrible. You know, when you tell anybody you write, most people will go, oh, neat. And the other people will go, I got this idea for a movie, man. And then it's like, oh, Jesus, you know. They have no clue what they're talking about. And this is why I want people to have a clue. You don't need to go to anyone else to write your film. You write it yourself. But when you start writing a film, you go into these angsty moments. And it could be as simple as how to format part of your script. You'll see old scripts written a long time ago or a script you really like, and you'll see how it's written and you'll think that's the way it should be written. And then you see a 2019 script and it looks nothing like a script written in 1980, one of your cult classic films or whatever you like. So I obviously don't have the consciousness of every agent in my mind or every reader in my mind or every director in my mind. But I'm going to give you sort of a redo, if you will, of episode 7, obviously in 4K and much, much better audio quality, but also with another, essentially almost 4 years of updated knowledge on doing this, submitting this, selling this, all this kind of stuff. But I'm really going to get on this particular episode is going to be about initially, how do you get started doing your own script? Now, the big deal that I tell my students is that the one thing that writers or aspiring writers typically forget is this difference between having a premise in your mind and having a story in your mind. Everyone usually approaches a story from its premise, and then they forget to write the story. And when they start, you know, they'll buy some screenwriting software, they'll start tippity-typing on the keyboard, and they'll realize they've got nothing. They just have a premise. Or maybe they've got a few scenes in their head that launch the premise, But at no point does anybody care about what's going on. Nobody cares about the actors or cares about their fictional, you know, associations with each other. And let me give you a classic example I give all the time, which is, and it's really funny. I was in San Diego and had this musician who just sang on stage, and that's all I'll say. He came up to me afterwards and was asking me what I was doing at the particular time. I was working on a script, and he's like, "Oh my God, you write movies?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "I got an idea for a movie." And so I said, "Okay, go for it." Because we're in the, you know, we're in a nightclub. It's really loud, whatever. And he proceeds to tell me the premise of Terminator 2, or actually Terminator 1, excuse me. "Well, there's this, you know, it's in the future, and this robot comes back in the past and chases down somebody to kill him so they don't do something in the future." And I'm sitting looking at this guy going, "You have seen Terminator 1 and 2, correct?" "Oh, yeah, but mine's better. Mine's different. You know why?" And I can't even remember what he said. It was so uninteresting. The premise of Terminator is this character coming from the future back to the past to kill the Connor kid. And Sarah just happens to be his mother. But she hasn't had the kid yet. And so she and she's mortal. She doesn't know anything about time travel or robots or anything like that. And so the premise is all the mechanics that make the story exist. A guy stuck on an island until he gets rescued. That's the premise. Everything that happens to that guy on the island, you have to make that interesting so that someone will actually want to watch it. You know, Tom Hanks doing Castaway, right? A girl being sent to the land of Oz. Well, the tornado that grabs her and spins her up in the air and takes her to the land of Oz. And then she lands and she meets these munchkins and the good witch and the bad witch and all this other stuff. And then she's told to follow this yellow brick road. Still all premise. What makes you care? Well, she's vulnerable, so they made her vulnerable. So you care. You have a maternal instinct to protect Dorothy in the land of Oz. Then she starts meeting these other characters. And each one of these characters holds on point an attribute of why we would care about anybody. One guy is looking for courage, one guy is looking for a brain, one guy is looking for a heart. And each one of these things will complete them as beings. And so, as they believe they do not have these things, we see their weakness, we see their frailty, and then they're challenged over and over on this path, this golden brick road to the Wizard of Oz. And then, of course, you have to have a good ending. But let's back up way before that. The whole thing about a premise is essentially to look at the world and say, what premises have been used a lot recently? Which ones would be considered a cliche? And those are the ones you have to avoid. Unless you are a genius, unless you've got a super duper spin. But let me tell you, even if you are a genius, you might want to write that script and hold on to it for 10 years until that cliche that you wrote it on top of disappears for a while. Hell, maybe even 20 years. If you're a good writer, you'll be able to write as many scripts as you need in the meantime, but at least you got that one down on paper. Now, the story is to somehow make someone of the audience care. They have to fall in love with someone or something, usually always someone. Something would be they have an illustrated utopia, a world peace, so they're falling in love with the state of the universe, and then things go bad. Falling in love with someone is to find someone that touches on all the moments of integrity that we prize as the current day society. But now think about our society today. It's become far more complex. It's always been complex, but it's even more complex today. Gen Zers care about a whole host of things and don't care about other things. Millennials care about a different set, X, baby boomers, and that's how you have to break everything down in your mind. And I guess it's sort of unfortunate if you're not a very creative writer that you have to deal with those constraints. But it's the truth. You need to just think it through a little bit. Now, if you just have a beautiful thing and you can feel it from the beginning, middle, to the end, then you should just write that script. Because someone else will take that great script, that great premise, and that great story, and they'll make slight adjustments to it to make sure that it touches as many people that would buy tickets as possible. My writing teacher says, he goes, if a reader for Hollywood, when this is for those of you brand new to this whole thing, if you submit your script, and most people don't want to read scripts anymore, they want to read treatments, and I'll explain that as we move down the line here. If a reader were to be given a extremely well-written script that has a boring premise and a boring story, but they pass it through because it's so well-written, I mean, it's so well-formatted, the use of words is really, you know, decorative and what have you, but they pass that through, they'll get fired. I'm telling you that so you don't worry about that as much. They don't like to see errors, but here's the other, the flip side of the game. If a reader were to reject a script with a fantastic premise and a fantastic story, but simply because it was written poorly, I mean, you can write it so bad no one can figure out what's going on, but as long as someone can figure out what the hell you're trying to say, that reader would be fired. They are to pluck out of your script and be able to communicate up to perhaps their boss, you know what, this is a really shitty script, but in terms of the way it's written, but the story is actually pretty damn cool. We might want to just option this thing and have our people rewrite it real quick. I already got a ton of ideas. And then they'll pitch the way it should go to their boss, maybe make a footnote about how bad it was the way you wrote it, and they'll get it sold. You can still make some money. It's amazing. Good ideas are the things that are missing. But sometimes you don't know when your idea is done. And this is what we're going to get to here. Now you'll hear that movies are in three acts. And this is sort of an old-fashioned technique where you wrote a 30-page beginning, a 60-page centerpiece, and then a 30-page, well, you can write a 5 to 30-page conclusion. You can conclude it in 1 minute if you want. The third act is sort of all over the place. You can make it big or small, whatever you need. I find that if my scripts are fantastic, they will just end when they end, and that's it. Sometimes I need another 75 pages after that, but then I'll write the 120-page version and simply tell my agent, look, this should go another 45 or 45 minutes or something like that, but I just pinched it down, so you guys get the idea. I am going to explain to you the four-act format because it is a much easier format to understand. A lot of folks, when you go to screenwriting classes or you read books about it, and I've only been to McKee classes, but I've met some teachers who write, who teach screenwriting. That second act, they always used to brag about how it would make you a man or a mouse. If you can get through it, you can get through it. But once you cut that act into two pieces, so it's 30, 30, 30, 30, boy, it comes a lot easier, at least from my mind. And I got a pretty good ability to hold my whole script in my brain at one point, you know. You'd probably do too. And so you're trying to figure out, you know, how do you break down your script? How do you get this idea down on paper such that when you sort of fill in all the slots, you can at least start realizing you got the critical mass to then take it to the next level? For me, that was a big deal when I was younger trying to figure this thing out, because until I heard George Lucas give this little trick, and he's a three-act writer, at least he was, and then I took his trick and I switched it for four-act writing, man, everything got great. And then I combined the very first screenwriting teacher I ever read, a man by the name of Sid Fields, S-I-D Fields, F-I-E-L-D-S. I do suggest you get probably one of his intro books and tab through the book. You want the physical book because he has this diagram that he uses to break down the three-act format. I don't know if he switched his books to four, but even if you have the three, it won't hurt you all, especially based on what I'll add to that. But 30 pages is 30 minutes on screen. That's generally how they think about it in the 20th and 21st century, well, at least the last half of the 20th century. Now, back in the day, it wasn't like that. They would write Casablanca, again, 176 pages. The whole thing is acting in about 93 minutes or something like that. So we used to think faster, talk faster, and communicate faster, but we're all kind of stupid today. So it's one page per minute. But how do you break that down? Here's your golden rule. And you can change this. This is the way to start. This isn't the way to finish. This isn't some, you know, police force telling you how to write your script, but this will get you to the basics. Think of it like this. For each act that you're going to write, and again, the fourth act for me is the last act, and so you don't necessarily need to be as brutal with this. You'll know what you need to do, and it'll feel right when it happens right. And that won't be a big mystery that I'm leaving you with. You'll actually be okay. And McKee doesn't teach this. Each act needs 12 scenes on average. That's what you need. 12 scenes will get you up to the 30-minute mark. It's a little under 3 minutes per scene, but some scenes are going to go quick and some scenes are going to need a little bit more time. So you might only have a page for one of these scenes and you might need 4 or 5 pages for the other scene. So this is how it balances out. Now, each one of your acts has a responsibility. Your first act is what we typically would call the setup. You're going to set up your premise. You're going to establish your characters. You're going to establish most likely where your characters will physically be in the world. Now, there are some exceptions with superhero movies and Fast and Furious things. Hell, they might start in Egypt. And by the 31st page, they're in America. But at least the premise should kick off to the point where it'll make sense as to why that's the case. Same thing goes for Mission Impossible and that kind of stuff. We're expected to jump around. Those are advanced scripts, if there ever was one. You need a lot of homework to write a script like that. And it's literally, your office would be covered in research in order to do this properly, in my opinion. Now, you know, I've heard mixed messages about this right now and in 2019, but there used to be very intense goals, and I want you to keep these goals because I think that you want to have it for your own purpose because it will guarantee that you're headed down the right path. And sometimes this will be extremely easy and extremely obvious if you have a really good story that's just telling itself inside your brain and you're just a slave getting it down on paper. But at the end of Act 1, they call it the plot point of Act 1. Now, what I'm going to be telling you is a generalization of what happens most of the time. And it's around 30 minutes into a film. And it's amazing. Back in the day, in the 80s, you could just hit movies and go right to scene, maybe 28 minutes into a movie after the credits finish rolling. And there it is right there. You can feel the pop of why you're there. Like in Poltergeist, it would probably be where they realize the house is haunted and something's gone wrong. Maybe the kid disappears by the 30-minute mark. I can't remember. But you want to say, look, this is why you're sitting in your seat. This is what you were hinted at in the trailer. But isn't this so much better? I've revealed so much more to you since you paid that ticket back there. And now you're ready to sit for the rest of this film. The other 90 minutes of this film, perhaps. So the first act is probably the most fun you will have in your entire script because you are expected to do whatever it takes to set this thing up. And so you can put people in all kinds of different places, all kinds of wild things. Maybe you're bringing a bunch of people together. And when they get together, pow, this thing happens. You know, 100 movies like that, right? But then your second act ends in the center of your film, of a 120-minute film. 120 pages is, you know, 30 times 4. So right in the center of your film, you have to turn this baby, and we're going to get into the word called turning, which means you turn the perspective of the viewer upside down. What they thought you were doing with this script just went to the next level. What someone likes to do, and if you think about magic tricks are the perfect archetype for writing. They show you some coins, your close hand, proximity, got their sleeves rolled up. They're turning their palms up and down. Look, I got nothing. I got no sleeves to put anything on. They'll typically have some felt in the table. But you don't care. You want to be blown away. But they'll say, okay, this is what we're going to be doing here. And they'll tell you some basic mechanic that they're going to do. And you're like, okay, I get it. I've seen that kind of trick before. And then before the trick is over, something mind-blowing has taken place here. The unthinkable. Now, typically in magic tricks, it's the very last thing that they do that just utterly makes your adrenaline, your dopamine, your brain just pops. It's a wonderful thing. And then at the end of Act 3 of our 4-act format, You are setting everything up. Everything that's at stake, everyone that could be hurt, killed, kidnapped, vaporized, whatever the case might be, whatever can be lost, a war that's lost, which means that the bad guys win. It's all being set up. And hopefully you don't have to introduce some random thing in your script to save yourself in the fourth act. And they call this Deus Ex Machina. And this means, it's the way the Greek theater used to work, where they would get themselves painted into a corner in their story. Everyone's going to die, and then all of a sudden a god would show up. They'd literally rattle some steel, someone would walk on stage, maybe they'd blow some smoke, and here's a particular god, Zeus or Athena or something, and they solve the problem. And it's hooray, you know, that archetype worked for a little while. But now it's very frowned on. If you introduce a character that hasn't been in the script, but maybe one time or never in the script, and you're just using that as a little mechanism to save your butt, you're in trouble with the reader, and your script will be panned unless someone else can go, okay, that's a horrible idea, but I got a different ending. We're going to license this thing from your option from you with this better ending. And then your fourth act is simply your resolution to everything. Now, you know how these things work. Sometimes a resolution in a script just goes straightforward, boom. There it is. And everybody's expectations, hopefully, were not met. They were changed, turned, and flipped, and then met better than what they assumed was going to occur. One of the best descriptions I've heard about writing a film is it's a tree. It's sort of a tree of life. And every single thing that your story could do as a branch could do. But you, the master artist, have found the one branch that is better than all the other branches based on what? The generation that you're aiming the film towards, where we are in society, what cliches have been completely exhausted in society, what genres of movies have just been done too much, right? If you're staring at Hollywood and they're coming out with sci-fi movie after sci-fi movie every single year, and you are just starting an idea, if you dive into sci-fi without someone paying you to do it, and you can write really fast or something, then the likelihood is you're going to hang on to that script 10 to 20 years before anyone will do it. Or, in some cases, they'll have you rewrite it as a Western or a different genre. That happens all the time. The gentleman that invented, that wrote and directed, I don't know if he directed it, sorry, but he invented Deadwood, the series on HBO. He wanted to do Rome. Went to HBO and they said, we already greenlit Rome, believe it or not. Why don't you find a different location to run all of your ideas through, your themes, which we're going to get to, at a different time and place, because we just can't do this. And he searched and searched until he found Deadwood, South Dakota. It was a rich, beautiful piece of history, and he was able to push all of his themes into this other Western genre. And thank God, Rome wasn't bad, but Deadwood stomped it like a fly, man. Now, that's the basics. I want to get that out really quickly so you just understand. Now, I guess I should loop back very quick to cover what we might call a subplot. Subplots are a little tricky for new writers. And it would be that there's two storylines going at once. Storylines are all about resolution. You create a problem, and then you resolve it. That's sort of what the film's all about. Every film you've ever watched is there's a problem, and we're solving it. And the more complex and unobvious your problem is, the more you're going to have fun with your script because the audience is completely confused about how to fix this. They don't want to be confused about what the hell you're talking about, but I'll give you an example. If any of you have seen the movie The Professional, or as it was called in France, Lyon, it's a French guy playing an Italian hitman. But it's a hitman that lives in a building, some brownstone in New York. He takes his orders from a guy that runs a pizza parlor, and he tells him who to kill and what to do. And he's a very quiet, super shy guy. But he happens to live next to this loud, obnoxious family where this little girl lives. And she is kind of neat, kind of a smart kid. But the whole family's all tied up in their own thing. There's one little boy in there who's completely innocent. And one day, she goes down to get milk, and the cops come up, and one of the lead cops is Gary Oldman. This is Gary Oldman's best role he's ever played. And that's saying quite a bit because I love everything he's ever done usually. But he comes up and he accuses the father of that family of cutting some cocaine and stealing it. And the guy's denying it and denying it and denying it. And so he's like, look, man, I asked you nicely before, which was not so nice, to get me, you know, the money you owe me, the coke you owe me, whatever. And he just keeps saying, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, man. And they blow the whole family away. Except this little girl is out getting milk. And of course, the hitman's knows exactly what's going on because it's his next door neighbor. And he's looking out the peephole. And at one point, when one of the guys walks up to his door and kind of starts looking at the peephole, and he's got this gun like right on the door, and he's like the baddest hitman on planet Earth. He could have killed all those guys in 2 seconds, but you know, you mind your own business in New York. So here comes a little girl. And they know that if she is part of that family, well, she knows if she's part of that family, she's going to get killed. Just the way it works. So she walks past her own door, she's got this, you know, little bag of groceries with her. And she knocks on the door of the hitman. And the hitman's like, he doesn't take in people. He doesn't get involved with anybody. He can't fall in love with anybody. He can't have a life outside of being a hitman because that'll screw him up. It's just the rules of the game. And so he's sitting there and he has kind of a thing for the girl because he's got the paternal instinct to protect a child. He has a rule, no women, no children. But those other guys killed women and children, and that obviously sets him off. So after just angsting and angsting at the door, he finally lets the kid in because she's just crying and she's holding it and she's whispering. She's like, please help me, please help me. I am screwed. And so he opens the door and lets her in. Door closes. The setup is finished. What the hell is this hitman going to do with a little girl whose family was just slaughtered next door? As horrific as it was, does he really care about this family getting killed next door? I mean, they broke the rules. They killed a teenage girl. They killed a little boy. They killed a mother. So they definitely broke his rules, but, you know, he's got his own business. And if he gets involved in things he's not supposed to get involved in, they could catch him and kill him and expose everything else he's done in life. And so, you know, the Bambinos are like, you don't do anything separate. And so it's a super complex setup. Now the audience has no clue what's going to happen next. What's going to happen between these two people that are absolute strangers to each other? One's an adult, one's a child. We know that by watching this guy, he's got this massive routine in his house. When he comes home, he sets up his guns a particular way. He dresses, he sits in a bed. He sits in a chair, and he kind of sleeps awake with his guns right next to him. So if anybody fucking makes a noise, he's like, wham, he's ready to go, right? So that's the main plot, is to set that kind of thing up. But here's the thing. There's something called plot fatigue. That's what I call it. And you will, no matter how amazing a film is, you will get tired of the main plot if you're just having to listen to it and listen to it and listen to it. So we create these relief points based on a subplot. And Star Trek, the television show, is absolutely brilliant at subplotting during a major plot. I'll give you a little example. A few episodes back, I told you I'd rewatched an episode where the fictional character Moriarty, who's Sherlock Holmes' nemesis, who 4 years earlier had become sentient in the holodeck, was reactivated by Barclay by accident and immediately demanded to see the Captain Picard, because he's like, you told me you'd get me out of here, and I just spent an eternity in the computer, and I was conscious the whole time. And they're like, we didn't know you were conscious. We would have never done that to you. But now outside, what's going on is the Enterprise is pulled up next to this merging of a planet like Jupiter and a star. I think it was a star. And through gravity, they're sucking each other up, and so they're watching this Jupiter get swallowed up, and then I think they envision it was going to be a burst once the chemicals ignited from this hydrogen ball. And so there's a moment they're going to be able to watch it. Then they have to haul ass back and watch the explosion or get away from it because it's dangerous. So this is just a standard thing the Enterprise does, right? No big deal. Little subplot going on here. But Moriarty, through various means, gains control of the entire Enterprise and locks them out of flying the vehicle. And so he says, look, you either get me off this ship, get me out of your holodeck, get me off this ship, or I'm just going to let you guys die. And of course, they're trying to beg him to reason and all this other stuff. But so the tension that they built up was between the subplot and the plot. They have an impending doom outside, but this guy wants to get the hell out of Dodge. It's beautiful. It adds the tension. Now, in their particular case, they carried the subplot all the way to the very end to keep the tension on the moment, because it's only relatively 45 minutes for television once you subtract commercials. But for you, they have something that Sid Field came up with, which is what he calls the pinch points. And he usually links this to a subplot. Doesn't always have to be a subplot, but it needs to be something interesting at the 15-minute mark of the second act, meaning directly in the center of the second act, and the 15-minute mark of the third act, again, on a four-act system. And usually he draws a little sine-cosine wave just so your brain kind of tracks it together. So you could be setting up the subplot at page 45, and then 30 pages later, at page 75, you're resolving the subplot. Just a little thing, just something, could be a special character. And again, you don't have to actually resolve it at those points, but that's two areas where you need to have something occurring that's going to keep the interest of the audience that's sort of off base. You know, in Ragnarok, the recent Thor movie, I'm not sure this is the exact pinch points, but there was a sort of a character development thing between Thor and the Hulk. And they talked about, you know, working together to resolve the issue. And it revealed a bunch of things about how the Hulk kind of left the universe of, you know, the Marvel universe with the other guys, because he kind of disappeared in a weird way. And I don't think I even saw that film that set that up in that particular way. But just keep that one in the back of your head. But now let's go on to the characters. Your characters are extremely important. One of the things you need to make sure you do is obviously develop a great protagonist, meaning a good guy or gal, and an antagonist, a bad guy or girl. Like Ragnarok, bad girl. Now, what's interesting about this is that we have seen so many movies now, so many TV shows, so many series made for TV movies, that it is getting increasingly difficult to create an interesting, original character. And the audience knows this. The audience is just looking for something a little bit different. And this is where you work your entire world together to give the accents and the opportunities to make these characters amazing. Now, one of the things I haven't mentioned yet that starts to get to the character development and your entire script in general is you want to have set up before you really get deep into any writing of any kind. Now, I mean, not your scene structure and stuff, your scene outline, you know, the 12, 12, 12, 12. You can do that as fast as you want. But even before you get into writing the center part of your film, the 24 scenes that'd be in the middle, I would suggest the following order. Write your first 12 scenes to set up your script. And again, if you're plus or minus a couple, it's no big deal. It's no rules. Just hit page 30 with your idea. And immediately write the ending. Make sure you've got something popping on the end. Because I will tell you this. If you can write a great ending having not written the film at all, believe me, by the time you get to the end of your film, whatever great idea you had will be way better. Because you already put in like a life raft up there. You're like, I'm okay, because if I can't think of anything else to do for my script, I got a great ending already. Super duper important. Now, what I will see from amateurs who want to get into this, it's almost like the kids that go and sing for American Idol back in the day that are completely tone deaf. People will steal other people's recently written and produced film and television arcs. They will just rip something off and say, well, that's my ending. And it's like, you listen to it and you're like, yeah, well, Stranger Things just did that. Or, you know, Mission Impossible just did. I know, but, you know, mine's better. You know, just weird sayings like that. You have to have some originality. Otherwise, this isn't going to work. Now, maybe your ending isn't quite as original as it needs to be. As long as you're a responsible person and you realize that as you write this thing, You're going to make it better at the end. And you just know that in the back of your brain. Keep thinking about it. You're going to think about your script constantly. If you're writing your first script, unless you're photographic memory, it'll be hard at first to hold your whole script in your brain at once. But very quickly, the more you exercise it, you will be able to hold a whole script in your brain at once. It's phenomenal. And what's interesting about it is that 120 pages will feel like a tiny postcard in your brain. It's really interesting once you get good at it, which is just through practice, right? Now, character development is very interesting, and I've got a technique that I do that I've never seen anyone else do. I'm going to pass it to you because I'm not going to covet this stuff. I want you to write a great film. I mean, if I made this whole season, or sorry, this whole show, and I put out 400 plus shows, and one movie came out of one of you seeing an episode, and you were right on the precipice, you already had all the skill, I'm not giving you skill, but I gave you some organization, and you wrote one great film, and you let me know, and I went and paid and watched it, and I was like, oh my God, this wouldn't have existed had I not just pushed someone just a little bit. That would make this whole show worth it, trust me. Believe in yourself, because this stuff can work. Now, the other thing about writing films, while we get to the character writing, is you're going to need a piece of paper and a pen. You're going to need a notebook. I get computational notebooks from the Mead Corporation. They're great. They're about 25 bucks a binder, but they last forever. It's grid paper inside. Highly recommend you get one of these and a really good pen. Something that just makes it go well. Don't use pencil because pencil fades away. Pencil gets erased. Make the mistake. Who cares? No one's going to look at this stuff but you. But what you do right away is you get like an 8x10 piece of paper. And towards the top, leave yourself some room above this, but write your character's, your protagonist's name. Down towards the bottom of the paper, leaving a little bit of space around that character, write your antagonist's name. And then draw a circle around it. Some oval, whatever you got to do, a little cartouche around your character names. Then, think about your script. On the good guy side, write down in a cloud around that character's name all the other names of characters that have to exist in your film, and I repeat, have to exist in your film for it to be as glorious as it's going to be. Any characters that don't need to be in there, whatever. You don't need to write down waiter one, waiter two, soldier one, soldier two. We're talking real main characters here, supporting characters. Then go down to the bottom of your page and write in all the villains, all the helpers of the villain. You know, Dr. Evil had his whole clan down there. Write all that down there. Then, if you know you have some flip-floppers, they're going to play both sides of the game, write them in the center, but not directly in the center of your paper because we're going to start drawing some lines here. And you want to draw these far enough apart that you can spell some words between them because we're going to do a little thing here. This is my gift to you. I wish someone had thought this up before I had started writing screenplays because it would have made it a lot easier. Now, draw a line from your protagonist's circle edge to the antagonist's circle edge. On one side of the line, we're going to write the physical relationship these two people have. It could be husband and wife. Could be father and son. Could be earthling and alien. That's one side. On the other side of the line, you're going to write down, you can turn the paper, right? You know, you can turn this paper all the way around. What is their beef between each other? Why do these two characters exist? For the classic movie Tron in 1982, you would have Flynn. Kevin Flynn is at the top, played by Jeff Bridges. Down at the bottom, you have someone called the MCP, the Master Control Program. He's an artificial intelligence. Well, drawn together, the physical relationship is man versus machine. On the other side, the MCP is holding Flynn captive inside the computer. That is the relationship that they have. You could even write, Kevin Flynn is trying to shut down the MCP by starting the Tron program. All right. Now, for all of your bubbles and all of your characters, and you can use a much bigger piece of paper if you'd like, I want you to draw lines where there are relationships. If two characters never meet each other and they have no relation to each other, that's of any significance. Now, you could do like Saving Private Ryan. You had a lot of soldiers in that, but they're all related to perhaps a main character. So you don't need to write a bunch of lines between all the soldiers unless something's going to be revealed that you think is interesting. But you draw a line between everyone's going to talk to each other in any significant way. On one side of the line, you write their physical relationship, buddy, mother, father, best buddy. On the other side, you put supportive, antagonistic. You know, there's parents that are assholes. There's parents that are great and supportive. And then you start, you know, understanding. You get a picture of your entire script. And then take a step back, because you will have thought of your film ahead of time, think you have it all figured out, and then the characters start living. Because if you can envision a story, just like the universe has all eventualities already calculated out, that story actually exists in the most perfect form somewhere in the universe, and all you're doing is querying the universe to pull that story back down to paper so you can tell it. And that's why a lot of writers say characters live on their own inside your mind. Now, I'm very pictorial. I'm very image-driven as a person. I don't know any writers that aren't that way, but I'm sure they are that way. So one thing you can start doing is figuring out some basics. If you have a character that you know is going to die, you could write a little tiny skull or some death symbol right by them to let yourself know when this script is over, these characters are going to be alive and these characters aren't going to exist anymore. Again, there's a ton of movies where nobody dies, so you just need to know. When I wrote my first film, it's sort of a horror film. And it's, you know, I tried to make it feel like a mix between The Shining and Poltergeist. And so it has some sophistication to it. But it's a mystery, so it's all kinds of twists and turns in it. It's like a big Twilight Zone movie sort of thing. It's been well received, let's put it that way. I hope you guys get to see that one day. But before we really had a lot of software to help us put this together, and before I learned the whole 12-scene thing, which you can do in Microsoft Word, I started killing off my characters way too fast. And then I did something that Sid Field says to do, which is actually not a bad thing. You get a bunch of 4x5 cards. I guess that's the size. Just a normal recipe card, you know, from like a flashcard sort of card. And you write all those scenes down. I don't do this. I don't know if you want to do this. It takes a lot of space in your house. But I'll tell you what happened as a result of doing this, and I'll tell you a digital way to do it that's, I think, a lot better. You would write down your 12 scenes on all these cards, and then you pick a wall in your house, and you literally put Act 1 card up above 2, 3, 4. Now, he had, you know, 3X system, but if you see all your scenes up there taped to your wall, if you want to rearrange them, you just rearrange the cards until it's chronologically correct. I can't even remember how I wrote this so poorly, but I remember at one point realizing that I should probably put a skull on a card where someone died. So I could see it in my head from far away. Okay, that's where someone's dying. And I had like 6 deaths in my script before it was half over, and more than half of my characters were dead. And now, not that many people die in the film, so I'm not sure how I got to that point. But doing that little symbol taught my brain, look how silly you're being. You're killing all these things off really quickly. So for you to put in your outline, your scene outline, just go to Microsoft Word, hit outline mode, and, you know, bullet list, do your 12, then give yourself some space, type Act 2, do 12 more, Act 3, 12 more, Act 4, 12 more, whatever you need. But put something in there so you can see that someone has perished, because they're leaving the script forever, unless they're Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? I've said this several times, and this is one that's a little tough to get used to at first when you first start writing. And if you're good at this, if you're good at anything that I'm saying is kind of tough at first, then pat yourself on the back, literally, because you are ahead of the game. But we have something called at stake. It is something that the audience doesn't want to lose just as much as the characters in your script don't want to lose it. Tron 1982. Very simple, what's at stake? You have Kevin Flynn that's sucked inside this computer in a laser bay that had been perfecting technology to pull mass inside of a computer and then project it back out. They did an experiment with an orange early in the movie so you could see that work. So you would kind of be familiar with it when it eventually happens to Kevin Flynn at the end of Act 1. And now he's inside of a computer. And so what is at stake right there? He could die in the computer and nobody would know. His body has been digitized out of existence into a computer. Huge deal. So now the entire time he's in that computer, you're like aware of, oh my God, what could happen? And you're making him play games. He's playing this game where you hurl this ball at this thing in the ceiling. It comes down, hits the rings he's standing on. He's got to play a light cycle game. He's got to avoid being chased by tanks. He's got buddies. But when he gets his buddies, which is a guy named Ram and a guy named Tron, he falls in love with these guys just like you do. So, as people perish in the script, you either want people to hate this person and be very glad that he's dead, or you want them to be heartbroken when this person dies. There really isn't a situation in between, except, you know, maybe again, in certain situations where a lot of people are dying, you can't have a heart for everything, but you want the viewer to be concentrated on one person. With Saving Private Ryan, when they took, I think it was Omaha Beach at the beginning of the film, it's one of the most amazing pieces of cinematic war footage. You don't know any of these people crawling on this beach. And so what Steven Spielberg did to help you have sympathy for what is essentially random strangers. Now, the nice thing is for him that we understood the unbelievable situation that was invading these beaches, and it happened in multiple places, right? But he put the camera right down in the face of these human beings. He puts you in the eyes of a soldier running off the, you know, the transport, and you know the camera's all bumpy, so you feel like you're at stake. You could be shot. And then as each person took a shot or whatever or succeeded, the camera's right down there, and so you're living inside this horrific moment. And it was just a masterful piece of everything. Great production. Great. You know, sound engineering, it was just fantastic. And that's now your responsibility to create those amazing scenes. And you could rip off a scene like that and simply change the context of when it's happening, where it's happening, draw from history, or make something up completely fictional. Now, if you're going to make up something fictional, you're going to have to put enough dialogue in to educate the audience as to what the hell's going on, right? But let's keep going with some of the basics. Because again, a lot of this stuff isn't said. Scene settings. In a script, you are to determine whether or not it's externally happening, meaning outside, or internally happening, meaning inside a room, inside a jet, inside somewhere. So the sky isn't up above. That's basically where it becomes an internal scene. Then you need to pick out what location you're at and what time of day. Time of day is a big deal because time of day provides visual information. If it is at daytime, well, if you had a ghost showing up during the day, it's a different experience than a ghost at night, where you don't have perhaps a lot of light information. You know, you've seen those scenes where people go down into cellars and they don't ever turn on the light. Or if a writer's intelligent, I just watched, was it Ash versus Evil series on TV? There's a scene where he goes down in the cellar because he's like, I got experience, let me go down there. I've got lots of experience killing things in dark cellars. But he comes around the corner and he flicks the switch and it doesn't work. That was a brilliant little twist by the writer to go, yeah, you know, we should probably, yeah, so it's always the cliche that no one ever tries to turn on a light. So we're going to break the cliche simply by having his hand flick the light switch and it doesn't work. Now we have it explained as to why it's dark. Someone busted the light or whatever. But as you are determining your scene outline, one of the things that will occur is you will move things. And you might move something from daytime to nighttime, not thinking anything of it. Well, in the end, you would have potentially killed the scene because it needs to happen at night. And you might think that that's easy to repair, but here's the thing. The more that you are dynamic with your script and willing to rewrite things before you hand it in to anyone, you will move things around because you're like, you know, it'd be better if he wasn't told that, didn't learn that until this, or be... He doesn't see his father reincarnated as a ghost downstairs until this scene, so you move it way down inside the script or something, or maybe way up in the script, and you have a daytime-nighttime problem. Your scenes, your scene headings, this is something I've only started to, I think, really begin to master my own style, but I'll tell you my style, and you can copy this, and it's a great thing to do. You know, a lot of it's, when you're a junior writer, you're like, you know, in a backyard, there are, you know, it's, these people are sitting there and they're doing this, and you're just trying to physically set up the scene. But in your brain, you're seeing a whole lot more characteristics of the scene than you're typing into your script. What I do is I now definitely set the physical scene, but when you type your external dot, EXT dot, and the software usually starts to write the rest of it, you know, puts it in bold writing for you, and you might say, you know, it could be Omaha, Nebraska, colon, you know, white trash backyard, or so-and-so's backyard, day, afternoon. And then you start to describe the fact that maybe a barbecue's going on behind this location. And what you want to do is pull out things that will make the reader feel the tone of your script. If you're doing a comedy, it might be a bunch of funny things occurring in this backyard, and you could just, sometimes you can just write a list of things. You might say, let's say you had a trailer park of some sort, and you're like, littered with flamingos, rusted out old chairs, and, you know, a propane tank or something. List the items that would be, make it just a landmark, indistinguishable setting for where your scene is taking place. Every word in your script is sacred. If it's not sacred, you erase the word. You erase the word inside of a dialogue, you erase the word inside of action, etc. So your scene description should be very, very powerful and right to the point. It does not have to be long. It could be two or three sentences. I typically, unless I'm vacillating between two, like if someone's having a phone conversation, let's say on a cell phone, you only need to describe each one of the locations once, and then you can flip back and forth really quickly. Telephone conversations are a little nerve-wracking because what'll end up happening is you wonder, should I say external, internal, one's on a cell phone, one's inside the kitchen. I tapped a buddy of mine. I said, what do you do with this kind of thing? And he says, well, I reverse one time, showing the audience that these are happening in two different locations. And then I just do character dialogue, character dialogue, character dialogue. And they know in their head, one person's in one place, one person's in the other place. So unless you're trying to pad your script, which believe me, they understand when you're trying to do that, and they frown on that, that's a technique to use as well. Now, let's move on to action. Because action is where screenwriting becomes screenwriting and not novel writing. You, when you get into film writing, are creating a visual experience, not a novel experience. What's the difference? Here's a novel line. Joey let out a huge sigh as he was noticing that his girlfriend no longer is interested in him. Well, that is a novel line. If you're going to put that in screenwriting, you might say, he let out a sigh, and then he has to say something. He has to do something physical, visual, in front of the camera. If it is not a visual thing that you are orchestrating in your action, then you have to erase it or think of a different way to do it, such that it is visual all of a sudden. I see this all the time. Now, let me tell you this little thing too, because again, rules aren't really rules, they're guidelines. If you are a person that wants to, you know, write perfection, then there is a kiss of death habit that you can build that you need to make sure you never build. So if you've never written before, or you've written a little bit, make sure you don't make this one mistake, which is, I'm not going to leave this scene until it's perfect. What's that do? That means that you could be on page 2 and you will never, ever write page 3 because you can't figure out page 2. Just do me a favor. Write your script. If you don't know what the hell to do, what the hell to say, you're not in a dialogue mood that night. You can't figure out what these characters would say. Don't worry about it. Start writing in your software Well, these two characters argue, and this person wins the argument. Next scene. That's all you got to figure out. Well, I don't even know how to work this thing out, but somehow this person has to get from this part of the room to that part of the room, and they had to, you know, they get a glass of water thrown in their face. Just get the main course of your action down. Now, hopefully you've done a little bit of this in your outlining software. Like, again, Microsoft Word is a great software, whatever word editing software you want to use. But what's interesting is once you start setting these things up properly, when you get to the point you need to write your dialogue, it starts to write itself in one way or another. But there's some very important things you need to know about dialogue that are considered to be the professional way to write dialogue. And if you turn in stuff that doesn't follow these two guidelines, they're very important guidelines, then you will have a much more difficult time selling your script. Now, why have you ever disliked a movie? Why have you ever walked out of a theater or turned off the television or gone to a different show on your on-demand service? It is because you got bored of whatever the hell you were watching. Probably either bored or it all became so predictable. You're like, oh my God, I know how this is going to turn out, whatever. All right. There are methods that Hollywood uses to immediately identify whether or not a scene has been written well or whether or not it should be erased. And really, eventually, if that continues to occur in your script, they're going to put it down and they're going to lick a pencil and they're going to put your pen and they're going to put a name in a little book over here and go, any more scripts submitted by this guy, don't waste my time. Don't even come back. And then you have to change agencies if you really screw it up. One is called on-point dialogue. On-point dialogue means that you are speaking the absolute obvious thing in the script. Now, if you're doing a comedy, you can play with this a little bit, but it's an advanced technique, so be very careful. You would have to almost be at the point where you're doing what's called breaking the fourth wall, where the character starts looking at the camera. That's happened a couple times in Deadpool. He makes a great joke, I think, in Deadpool 2 about breaking the fourth wall. And one other thing he did was really funny. But you were to write dialogue that insinuates what you're trying to say. It's almost as if at all turns, people don't want to say what's on their mind. They are beating around the bush and doing essentially passive-aggressive statements towards each other, especially if it's going negative, of course. Or they're trying to hide something. And you know, when you try to hide something, you're really trying to withhold the truth. And that's the cornerstone of every sitcom. Something happens at the beginning of the sitcom in the first 5 minutes, and that is concealed. Like a kid breaks, like an old day stuff. There was even a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air I mentioned in my old episode where I think one of the kids broke a lamp by screwing around and playing in the front room when they're not supposed to, playing a football or something. They broke a lamp, and it's a really coveted lamp by the mother, and so they hide it. And then, you know, there's been a Cheers episode like this too. And so they hold it for 20 more minutes or 18 more minutes or whatever. And at the end, they reveal they broke it. And the parents go, why didn't you just tell me the truth? It would have been okay. Accidents happen. Don't play football in the front room. Like I said, now you know why we gave you that rule. Yeah, okay. I love you, Mom, Dad. Boom. Roll credits. That's a very junior example of the art of hiding the truth. But now let's say, and I gave this example in my previous episode, probably in character development. But again, I'm giving you the sort of kitchen sink episode so you can get everything teased into your brain to figure out whether or not you got something to write. Let's say that a husband is cheating on his wife, and he comes home and he doesn't know, you know, if this is the time he's going to get caught or not or whatever, but this particular time he comes home late, but not so late it's like the wife's in bed. But she's perhaps taking her makeup off, and she's in her nightgown. Just that physical description of her will let the audience know she is sort of in that wrap-up stage of the night. And he comes in late. And, of course, if the guy is cheating, he's going to come home and probably sort of sauce up the wife if she's still up. You know, compliment her and be really nice because he just got his rocks off with somebody else. And he's feeling guilty. This is sort of his reverse technique. So that in itself is something you should pay attention to. Feeling a little bit of rain here. But she might say, You know, he comes in and gives his little salutation, which is a cliche of a guilty man. And then she says, well, you know what? I have been thinking about where we should go on vacation this year. I think we should do something huge. And he's like, what are you talking about? And she goes, well, you know, you've been working so late at work, the PTO, the personal time off, your extra credit, you know, hours is going to have a huge bonus check at the end of this year. And I think we should spend that check on a great vacation. And so she's basically calling his bluff. Oh, you're out working? Well, then let's figure out how we're going to spend that money this year, because it's a bunch of extra money we didn't plan on. Sorry, just got a ton of rain on me there for a second. Everything's all covered up, so we should be okay. I can get a little wet. So you want to talk your, you want to write your dialogue such that it is insinuating a more creative way to pull things out than to put it directly on point. If we sat there and watched him cheat on his wife and he comes home, you know, you could just have him straight up lie to her and she takes it and you're in the scene very quickly and then we have something at stake. He's now lied to her and obviously he's probably going to get caught at some point. Or if anything else, we're revealing his character type. He's a cheater. He's a liar and a cheater. And you can either play his wife as someone who is visibly not pleasant to be with, and then the audience now would feel a sympathy for the main character. You could show his guilt, you know, looking at his picture of his wife when they were really happy together, and then look at the picture of, you know, him with the you know, you gotta have a cell phone, he's looking at little Instagrams of her or whatever. You can spend that any way you want, but you want to spend all those scenes extremely unique so that they're not a big giant bore fest. Now, here's the advanced technique that will take you a little while to understand and probably take you a little while to master. And it takes me a long, took me a long while to even get close to even saying the M word. I am not a master at what I'm about to say, but it is an imperative of what I do. It is the alteration, or I should say the toggle between positive and negative. You will want to flip everything that's being said from a positive to a negative. For instance, him coming in and greeting his wife in a very nice salutation is a positive. Her throwing out that they're going to go on vacation here real soon could be construed as a negative because she's calling his bluff. He comes back as a positive. What are you talking about? She comes back as a negative. She is essentially telling him, if you're not working late, I mean really working late and not off banging some chick, then I got you. And, you know, marriages will, you put pictures of kids in there or something like that, and you put the fact that she's maybe a stay-at-home wife and she's devoted her whole life to the kids and he's off earning all the cash and she has the ability to take half of all of his money. I mean, everybody knows these things. So you kind of work with your audience to say, you tell that to an 8-year-old, they won't know anything about divorce law. You aim this film at someone in their 30s, boy, they know the divorce laws and they know it's not a happy occasion, right? So now we flip things back and forth as much as we possibly can in a scene. Now, what they tell you in a more microscopic level is if you have two positives in a row, that's an area to rewrite. I mean, literally, two things in a row that are like, hey, honey, how's it going? Oh, it's going great. It just stays positive the whole time. Then you better be inside of a comedy where you're setting up some euphoric situation that's going to go bad very quickly. Change is the name of the game. That's how you get all of these things to become interesting to the audience. Now, simply going back and forth between positive and negative doesn't quite get the job done. What would really kick this scene off that I'm giving you would be they tit for tat back and forth with innuendo comments about him doing late night work and earning a few extra bucks and her wanting to go off on a vacation. You can get the sense she totally suspects he's cheating. Now, what could happen is she corners him into a situation where she either says, you know, if you're cheating on me, you're done, right? And he doubles down on his lie and, honey, I ain't lying to you, baby, and da-da-da-da, so he doubles down, And you might have a situation where you manifest what they call a double negative. Technically, there's a triple negative as well. But it's when everything, like Breaking Bad was amazing at this, it gets bad and then it gets worse. And what ends up happening is by it becoming worse, if you remember the first few episodes of Breaking Bad, they killed a guy and then they were trying to dissolve him in an acid. And the chemist guy, the main character, tells the kid, go get this specific plastic container and put the body in that and then put the acid in. And he doesn't realize why that's important, so he uses the bathtub instead. He puts all the acid in the bathtub. So he comes home and finds out that, I forgot what else went bad, but something else was really bad. And then all of a sudden, before they roll the credits, the ceiling gives away because the acid has eaten through the bathtub because it was never supposed to be used to hold this stuff. And here comes down from the ceiling, the bathtub in pieces, the body in pieces, the acid's everywhere, it's going through the floor eventually. And they just basically stare down at this like, oh my God, we've got a worse situation. So that might be even a triple negative depending on everything that was going on in the scene. Let's rewind that Breaking Bad scene because it gets to the next thing you need to understand. This is really the last of the gigantic concepts for your scene structure. Now we're going to talk about turns because they're super important too. And we'll talk about cracking. Cracking and turning, for me, was what really put the two together, but we'll get to that one second. There's something called the gap, G-A-P, just like the brand of clothing. The gap is when a character is got a simple task they need to do. He told the kid, go to the hardware store and buy plastic containers with this exact type of plastic. Just turn it over, read what it's made out of, and it's got to be this type of plastic. Why? Because the acid wouldn't eat that particular type of plastic. It goes right through porcelain or other types of rubber. But the kid goes to the hardware store, and either he couldn't remember what it was or he couldn't find anything that was made of that particular plastic. I can't remember which way it works. I can see the scene in my brain, but I can't remember how it went down. So he doesn't buy it, or he buys the wrong one or whatever, because the body was in a bathtub. I apologize for not remembering all the details that I've only seen that one time. But that was a gap. He tried to do something, and then he wiggled around it, and that caused the next problem. In the movie San Andreas, which is the one with the rock in it, and it's all about an earthquake that happens in San Francisco, well, Rock and his wife, I believe in Los Angeles, this huge earthquake happens in San Francisco. I think it's that way around. Whatever. One of the two cities has the earthquake. One of them, the parents, and the other one, their daughter's in the one that had the earthquake. And so they're hauling ass to the town that had the earthquake. And they have a physical, funny, on-point gap. They're driving down the highway, and the earth has split apart. It is a physical gap. And so they almost go off the crevasse and die. And eventually they... I think they got a plane and flew over or something, because he can do everything. He can fly everything. He's kind of like a little James Bond. But they wouldn't have gotten into the airplane had they not had the gap in the ground. So your job is to gap the character all the way to the end of the film. And once you understand gaps, you'll see them all the time in every single story that you ever see where, you know, hey, it's going to be easy, and it's not. When Luke Skywalker is trying to put the two torpedoes down the vent to blow up the Death Star at the very beginning. Well, everyone's trying it at first, and it's really, really hard. And I think he did one that failed, and he had to come back around and do it again, and then eventually he uses the Force to break the gap. The Force had a use only because it had a gap preceding the first manual use, where he's trying to use the equipment to figure out when to push the button. And, you know, Obi-Wan says, you know, Luke, use the Force. Pow, he nails it. Now the Force has more of a purpose than just all the other reasons they had lightly outlined in the first film. Now let's talk about turns. Turns are gigantic. They can be gigantic. They can be kind of small, too. But turns are when more mystery and more unraveling occurs. If you're on the tree analogy, it would be when a new branch opens up. For instance, a mystery is where you have tons of turns. A mystery needs like 30 to 40 turns before the script's over. And some of these turns are going to be, you know, if you just think about playing the game Clue when you were a kid, some of these turns don't matter. They're just disinformation for the brain. And some of these turns are the one, the only one that matches all the previous things that really link back to the empirical, let's say a crime happened, someone murdered someone at a party in a mansion, just like the game. And so the process of elimination starts to occur for the viewer. You, if you can write mysteries really well, will become a master at turning. But think about a turn as simply the anatomy of this. The character that is experiencing the turn has discovered something new that completely changed their perspective of everything they had thought they were moving forward in all the previous pages of your script. Now, one of the best turns in the world happened at the end of a cliffhanger in Star Wars Empire Strikes Back. When Luke learns that Darth Vader is his father, that changes everything. That changed two movies, which is basically 4 hours of viewing time in your life, completely rewrote themselves in your mind. You're like, oh my God, what? This dude, Darth Vader, he's like on a Death Star. He's like, he's in control. He talks to the Emperor. And this dude is this farm boy's dad. How in the hell did that happen? Obi-Wan said he killed his father. And then they roll credits on you. I mean, really, it goes down and gets in the Millennium Falcon, flies away. But in the end, you don't get any more information about that turn. Let's wait till the next movie. And then we definitely bought that ticket. So there's something called cracking a script. And cracking a script in my circles has always been related to, we've got a great premise. And part of the crack is a very interesting term, because you're sort of doing the opposite of a crack. You're cracking open the story that's actually stuck inside the universe box that you're trying to tell this story. But a crack is when you figure out the magical formula between the story and the premise. What is going to be the one way to tell this story with your amazing premise idea that's going to make everyone go, oh my God, yeah, this is an awesome movie. You know, in Terminator, it's probably one of the best cracks ever, where you have him coming after Sarah Connor, and there's this extra dude that comes back to help her from dying, and he ends up fathering the kid, right? That's another turn, when he unanimously became the kid's father because of his involvement with Sarah Connor. It was a big deal. So the cracking thing is interesting, because here's what it happens in my life, because I write with at least one other person from time to time. And he will bring a premise to me and say, man, I got this idea. This premise is da 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 da. And right away, the premise is always amazing. You're like, oh yeah, man, that is awesome. And it's like, but I can't crack it. I can't figure out how to make this a 2-hour movie. You know, how do I elongate this concept to the point you want to see it for 2 hours? Sometimes people in my circles will have written a script, but it just wasn't that good. They wrote it without the crack. And so it became a very obvious thing. A good crack will keep you from writing cliches. It will force the dialogue and the action, everything, to be really interesting. So there's not a whole lot more to say, other than when you crack a script is when it looks like a feature film inside your head. You see the whole thing. And usually a crack will reveal, if nothing else, the first act and the fourth act beautifully. And then you can have fun with the second part of it, which is the center two acts. Now, one of the things you need to understand about writing film, and this goes for novels too, but I just don't write any of that stuff anymore, is that constraints are your friend. And for any of you that are fans of Game of Thrones, Star Wars, Star Trek, you know there are tons of rules about things that would never happen in those universes and things that would happen in those universes. And those constraints define your world beautifully and really allow you to write your characters a lot better. And so a lot of times folks will, some of the writers I've met in the distant past who complained about Hollywood tearing up their script or putting unnecessary demands on their script, I would say that they were never meant for this job. Because those constraints, those requirements that studios might give you, you know, they might say, we'll make that main character a girl. We're in a girl power phase right now. Make it a girl. Right now, you should always consider that for one of your scripts. This is called Superboy or something like that, right? But a good writer will never, ever shy away from any constraint, any necessity, because you'll see it as a challenge. And for those of you who've ever role-played in your lifetime, Dungeons & Dragons, Champions, all those vampire ones, you'll know. There's no such thing as constraints. Your players will always deny your storylines that you worked a whole week on before you role-played again, and they're like, I'm not interested in that. Let's go over here. And then you have to write a whole new night's stuff in your brain real time. That's why it's a great precursor to becoming a great writer. And playing as a character and seeing the GM or the DM sweat and invent something from scratch, that's also a great teaching tool for you. So some of the other little low-hanging fruit that happens when you're in your screenwriting software, there's something called mores and continues. More is anytime a paragraph is broken between two pages, it'll put the little thing in parentheses, more, saying this continues on the other page, so don't stop reading here, get to the next paragraph. I've been told to turn all that crap off. Continue is when someone is actually speaking twice in a row. So they'll speak, you put a little action in there, and you speak again. And that is where you will get a continue. Just turn all that crap off. It's more fodder for the mind to go around. Now, some of the other low-hanging fruit is, and most junior writers don't have the technical capability of doing this, but sometimes you come from the special effects world or other movie production areas, and you know about cameras and lenses and tight, wide, and, you know, medium shots. You can do a little bit of camera work with tight, medium, wide. You can say tight on this face, da-da-da-da. But a lot of times the directors will make those decisions, and so they don't want to be orchestrated as to exactly how a film is going to be filmed. That's what they do. The director of photography will get in there and decide, generally, this should be, you know, this kind of scene is best illustrated with a wide shot. And usually storyboards will occur before the film actually goes into shooting. So they'll have all these shots completely figured out. But they might frown on your script if you see yourself playing a role that is not your role. Your role is to come up with the story and the premise and weld them together through a crack and then write very interesting off-point, positive-negative dialogue. You need to gap things properly, and your gaps have to get bigger and bigger and bigger. That's something I forgot to tell you. So you start off with little gaps, and you go to giant gaps. You know, if it's some sci-fi script and aliens are coming in from outside, you know, the first gaps might be you can't find your gun. The main character can't find a gun. The gun jams. It doesn't affect the aliens. You see someone else. They see someone else, you know, use the gun on an alien, and they die because they're made of bulletproof ectoskeleton or something. So everything they're trying to protect themselves isn't working, thus putting more and more at stake as the character develops in front of the audience. But the final gap would be, oh my God, I got to fly up to the mothership and seed it with the virus or put a bomb on it or something like that. And how the hell are you going to do that? And so mortal man might have to jump into a spacecraft that's been stolen from an alien like they did in, you know, Independence Day and fly their ass up there and do something. So you want to pace your gaps and make them bigger and bigger and bigger. And you need to pace it in terms of how often the character actually runs into a gap, because they will get exhausted of this process. Now, I've negated, to use that term, a fundamental principle that is the overall guideline, because I think it's better described at the end of one of these lessons than at the beginning of one of these lessons, which is this. Robert McKee, who wrote the book Story, has coined a phrase called the controlling idea. It's a little utilitarian for me, that phrase. But the controlling idea is the overall drive of your character from the very first moment they enter the screen to the very last moment they walk off screen and you roll credits. Your script has a overall theme to it. And the theme would be something like good versus evil, man versus machine, man versus woman. There's all these different arcs out there that become your themes. And one theme is going to be picked as the overall theme, and it's very symbolic. It's not very on point, meaning you wouldn't say Kevin Flynn trying to escape the computer. It's sort of a good versus evil formula. And so as you're dreaming up your new scenes and your scene outline, those 12, those four 12s that you're going to put together, everything should yield either more information about how evil something is, how good something is, or what's at stake, if it's a good versus evil type formula. There's also something that's brilliant called a maturation script, which is your character is immature or unknowledgeable about something, and in order to be victorious at the end, they have to go off and get what Joseph Smith often referred to as the boon. The boon, I think it's spelled B-O-O-N, is like Luke Skywalker going to Dagobah to finish his Jedi training with Yoda. Because as much as the Force might be instinctual, it's also something that has got a massive power that he didn't know how to use when he said, get that TIE fighter out of the swamp. And you, I can't get that out of the swamp. It's too big. It's covered in water. No, and he's like, oh, he's with you. What can't be done? So he tries it, and he gets it out of the water a little bit, and then it falls back in the water because he doesn't have faith in himself. He doesn't have faith in the Force. He doesn't understand this stuff is infinite and all-powerful. You just have to figure out how to manipulate it. And then Yoda, what's Yoda do? He just goes, get out of here. Boom, and he pulls that thing right out of the swamp and sets it down. And he's just like, he's a little tired, but he's like, see, I'm 400 years old or whatever, however old the dude was. And he's like, I can do it. So you're young. You're a young whippersnapper with a ton of this Force stuff going through your veins. No more excuses. And through that example, the master taught the apprentice the thresholds of the Force, which are pretty limitless, right? Now let's talk really quickly about treatments, and then I'll reflect some of this back into your script. I wrote my first treatment when I had to put together the script for Chris Hemsworth on Cú Chulainn, the mythical character in Ireland, which I talk about from time to time. And we wrote the script first and then realized that the folks that had time to read this really didn't want to read the whole script. And so we ended up saying, okay, you know, making modifications to a 120-page document. If you got anything wrong or you come up with some new ideas, that could result in rewriting 80 pages, 100 pages. If you change one thing at the beginning, it could, you know, affect everything else. So we were moving very quickly because there was a huge time constraint on this thing. I think I took about 6 months of research and about 4 months to write it. But I very quickly was asked to do a treatment of it, which was essentially the first part of the document, which you'll have to get into. We'll have to get into it in a different episode, but it would be you picking the characters that have to exist, the main characters. They usually like to see some Hollywood picks, and who do you think these characters should be, literally the human beings that would play these characters. And then talk about your demographics, who you think you're going to hit. You give us a synopsis of your script, which is the, again, go look at the outlines of Twilight Zones on Netflix. Those are perfect mission statements for every single episode. Write it that tight, and you're going to be great. But when you get down to the treatment of your script, what I found to be the perfect formula is a 10-page outline, or 10-page, not really outline, but a 10-page version of your script, where each line is double-spaced, and one line per line, you try to keep anything from carriage returning. And you just go from start to finish in your script. This person did this. This person does this. It doesn't have all the qualities of a normal script. There's no dialogue whatsoever. It's all action. Yeah, there, you could put a few key phrases that are in the script that are powerful to the script. I mean, if you were to say, write an outline of or treatment of Empire Strikes Back, you would probably put the thing, you know, depending on what Mandela effect you're into, Luke, I'm your father, or no, I'm your father. Just so that someone can go, oh my God, you know, while they're reading this treatment. But it should be just as powerful as your script. It's probably even more powerful because it's more consolidated. You're just really getting to the point of everything that's there. But they need to feel every emotion that you want them to feel. And you must describe it in a visual way the entire time, because this is a visual art, right? Now, once you write your treatment, and you might even do your treatment first before you get into your screenwriting software, and nobody likes to have delays, but I tell you what, I'm not telling you this to slow you down. I'm telling this to save your skin, to make sure that you become a professional and make sure that you don't waste time. Because if it gets difficult and you've never done it before, you might give up. And that's the wrong thing to do. So I'm trying to keep you from having those give up moments by doing it the right way. But if you had a 10-page, double-spaced, complete reenactment of your script, then when you get to your 120-page write, you're going to know what works and what doesn't work. I put a tremendous amount of effort into my 12-scene times 4 thing to make sure this thing works. Now, what I typically do in my action, in addition to everything else I've told you, making sure it's all visual, of course, is one, you literally will get to the point you will be erasing every word you can possibly erase. I used to write run-on sentences in my action, thinking that that would be easier to read. Just read one big long sentence and then poof, you got all the information you need. I now don't do that. I write a couple short sentences. I try to make, as just a personal goal of mine, any action that I'm inserting into a script, especially between dialogue, because no one wants to stop reading dialogue and read action, because the dialogue is the rich part. It's the truly visual, they're seeing it in their brain thing. Don't interrupt them if you can. But any of my action, I try to make it no more than 2/3 the width of the script and only on one line. And what'll end up happening is you'll become a wordsmith. You will find ways to say things in shorter formats than you ever have in your life. But now here's the thing. Don't get caught up in that perfectionism loop. Again, write whatever the hell you got to write just to get the damn thing finished. I'm helping a buddy right now with the rewrite. He just sat in Hawaii and wrote this in 30 days. And now I'm in there. He didn't even put periods on the end of his sentences. I commend him because he didn't lose track of getting to the bottom of the script. And a lot of his dialogue is pretty flat and doesn't go back and forth and doesn't have any character. And he knows that. And that's why he's contacted me. Say, dude, could you rewrite this for me? You know. So one of the other action tricks you can do, and dialogue tricks you can do, is if you have a... I'll give you a couple examples. If you want something to move really, really quickly because it's a rapid-fire action scene, you want to start using really short words. Short words in the dialogue, short words in the action. If you have to describe a lot of stuff in a paragraph because some big physical thing is occurring, a robot shooting a missile and that kind of stuff, tiny little words will read a lot faster to the reader and keep the pace going such that it feels exactly like it would be on the screen. So use that little trick. One of the other techniques is if you have to do something like bullet time, something's going to go in slow motion, you just simply write in all bold above your action, the following thing happens very quickly or happens in slow motion. And then you want to put at the end of that action, time resumes. That way they understand this went slow and this is going quickly. If you're going to do something like that, make it a big moment. You know, if you have a guy diving in a room like The Matrix, where there's all that fire going on in the police station, and he's diving in the room, and he's jumping off the pillars. I never read the script, but that would be something you would, it's a big moment in the script. And so someone is adjusting their brain, trying to think about things in slow motion, and what happens has to make really quick sense in slow motion. You don't want to further complicate things by going into bullet mode and then describing a bunch of complex stuff. You will find times that things are hard to describe. When I wrote a sequel to Tron Legacy, technically Tron 3, it wasn't the script that was canceled. You can get a copy of it on the Locke Facebook group. I had to describe new games that I had invented, and being a game designer, I had, you know, 20 years of writing game design documents, but I had to put together the physical properties of the game, like if they're writing light cycles or modified light cycles, there's balls flying around, how does it work? Some of it's coming out in the dialogue because the character doesn't know how to play the game either, and he's like, how's this thing work? Well, you know how to play this? Yeah, well, it's just like that. Something like that. But they can't reference something in the outside world because they were programmers, their programs in the inside world. And so they have to reference things. It was the only point where, when Steven Lisberger read it, he was like, I'm getting confused about this game. And I'm like, yeah, I've been rewriting that for like, you know, 3 months, man. Then there's the idea about copywriting your script. And here's my advice about copywriting your script. Unless you are pitching your script, unless you are handing it into your agent or distributing it some way where you think it might be stolen, you want to keep it out of the copyright realm for as long as you possibly can, because I believe you only get 5 years and then you have to recopyright it. I think you can recopyright it. Just change a little bit and recopyright it again. Because people can get access to your script after it's copyrighted. And they can poach all kinds of ideas out of your script and never pay you a dime. I was on a project with another guy. We worked really, really hard on this script. He wrote it. I helped him rewrite a little bit of it, and it turned into Transcendence. And they ripped us off like you wouldn't believe. So just bear that in mind. When you're selling your script, it goes like this. You will get, obviously, a core amount of money for your script, depending on how talented you are, what your reputation is. So you may not get a gigantic amount of money for your script. I've heard first-year scriptwriters getting a little over $100,000 for their script. And when you put a whole, you know, 2 or 3 years into a script before it actually sells, that's pretty much fair. That's the fair minimum that you would get for putting that time into any other profession in the world. As you amass your reputation, you can start getting several $100,000 for your script, and depending on how amazing you are, you could even claim a seven-figure amount of money. But don't think that stuff's coming right away. I would say this, you know, barring a horrible tragedy in payment for your script, and they're only going to option it for a certain amount of time. They typically won't buy it forever. Buying it forever should cost a lot more money than optioning it for a year. Sometimes they'll option your script because there's another script very much like that one, and they don't want yours to sell to any other studios, so they pull you off the opportunity block, get their movie out the door, then they let the option return back to you, and good luck selling your script because they just did one similar to yours. But you're going to make your initial lump sum of money, and then as you get better, here's what you can ask for. But this is only after you've done this a few times. Or, I mean, you know, there's always a lottery ticket situation, but you can't base your life on this. You can actually ask for points on the film, meaning a percentage of the gross. Now, you got to have some serious chops to ask for that. And you got to have some serious legal representation, that kind of thing. You're only going to probably get a fraction of a percent. But that's a lot of money. Every time the movie airs, every time it's shown on TV, you get this little check in the mail. So it's worth it. Now, a TV writer has a completely different situation. They get a good lump sum of cash. Let's say they make $150K from a script, like a TV show, like a NCIS sort of show. And then every time it airs again, you make half. So 150, 75, down, 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 down. And then it sort of caps out, I think, or bottoms out around $5,000 every time it shows on TV. And you hope the thing goes into syndication because then you can go to your mailbox every morning and collect rent. If it happens one time in the world, your rent's paid for, right? What's really fun about writing, let me just tell you this, to get it, kind of give you a bump. The awesome thing about writing is no matter how amazing or unamazing your life is in real life, when you become a writer, you are God. You are creating your own world. If you think about it, and you do want to create your own constraints for your own world, if you created a new Star Wars universe that's all yours, it's not called Star Wars, you definitely want to create your constraints and stuff to create your own universe, but you get to go and live in a world and develop characters that do things that are out of this world. Or they could be super subtle romances or what have you. What ends up happening with a lot of the rookie writers I talk to is... And I don't mean they're lacking talent by any means, calling them rookies. They just never sold anything before. They haven't written one before. They'll usually pick something really simple because they've heard you got to write what you know. And there's definitely a ton of truth to that. But they'll end up writing some really difficult. They think they're picking a simple script and they're picking a super difficult script. If you've lived a really amazing life, sometimes those things just fall out of you and it's amazing and everybody gets it. But sometimes, you know, kids that are, you know, second year of film school trying to write about a couple getting divorced, and they're trying to write it from the perspective of the spouses, and they've never been married before, they've never been divorced before, they've only heard stories. The amount of subtlety that they will miss that is the true grit of those horrible experiences for people will never exist in the script. And that's because of something I say, which is they haven't lived enough life to write about life. So you're not really writing about what you know. It would be easier for that person to write a crazy science fiction comic book world than it would be for them to write something about what goes on in their front room. Now, some people have that amazing talent. I think Tarantino had that amazing talent, still does, of course. But he's an anomaly, which is why you know his name like a household word. Now, if you know in your heart of hearts that I'm full of crap and you've got that talent, don't listen to me stopping you from writing that script. I'm just telling you, if you're capable of doing that, that I'm giving you an award ahead of time. Now, one other quality that some of you will be able to manifest while doing this, but hopefully you have this quality prior to getting into this art, is you are a doer. What's that mean? That means you do things because you have to do things. These are passionate pastimes to your heart. You're a writer and you simply have to write. That's me. I can't stop writing. Doesn't matter if I never sold a single script, I'd probably still write them. I just have to. They mean something to me. Like several musicians will talk about their songs being their children. Your films are your children and you want them to be made because you believe the world will get something out of the story. Let me give you some goals with your scripts. And, you know, all scripts are different, of course. If it's a comedy, you're going to want someone to love your comedy. They're going to have, like, think about Something About Mary. Who converses about Something About Mary, which came out, I don't know what, nearly 20 years ago? I don't even remember when that came out, but everybody remembers the moment where she grabs something off her ear and puts it in her hair because she thinks it's hair gel, and it's not hair gel. And, you know, I had to see that movie 3 times in the theater to hear what they said for the next 60 seconds after that. She came on screen with their hair all pushed up. Was it Cameron Diaz? You couldn't hear because everyone was laughing so hard. And when you mention that script today or that movie to someone today, everyone mentions that scene. That is your goal if you write a comedy. You need to have people remember your jokes. Blazing Saddles, oh my God. There's dozens and dozens of those scenes. When you know Blazing Saddles and you love that movie, you could just sit around and probably finish 2 cigars just riffing that movie and reenacting those scenes and celebrating with your friends that you both like that scene. But for films that are more in-depth and have serious meaning, you're going to want someone to come out of that theater talking about the issues that you raised in the film. First time that ever happened to me that I really remember was Natural Born Killers with Woody Harrelson. He gives a dialogue at the end of that film, and he talks about why he is the killer that he is and the fact that we're all just animals and we're lying to ourselves that we're not. I was also worried about the carnage that would happen after that movie happened because I thought, man, someone's going to kill someone after seeing that movie because it riles you up, you know, just gets into your feral state of mind. And that's masterful writing, masterful writing. If you're leaving them with a giant Luke, I'm your father moment, that's an epiphany you'll talk about for the rest of your life. Everybody talks about that for the rest of their life. You're in control of these stories, folks. You're in control of where those mysteries exist, how they are resolved, whether there's a twist. Someone thought their brother was their brother, but they were really their father. I mean, like all kinds of wild things that can happen in a script. And so this should get your juices flowing if you're a creative person. There are steps to getting to the script. The kiss of death would be jumping in your screenwriting software and pounding out scenes. Someone asked me recently, how much can I write in a single sitting after I've got my script outlined and worked out? It was an interesting question. I'm not sure why that answer is got any validity to it, but I think they were trying to figure out whether or not they were pacing themselves correctly by getting an extreme example from someone who does it and has done it for 20 years plus. And so what I told them was, I said, look, probably the most I've ever written in one sitting is 45 pages, which is the first act plus the next 15. I will put a caution out to you if you do one of those marathon writing sessions. Any of you who've run track, and I was a fool when I joined track, I ended up being a long jumper, can you imagine? Was that my coaches in track, they never taught us anything about how to do anything. They expected you to have had a previous life as a track runner, and you know all the ins and outs of everything. You know how every shock put and javelin works, you know how to run a marathon. I mean, it's like, it's crazy. But they asked us to run, I think it's called the 440. I think you run around the loop four times, the course, and then, of course, you're pacing yourself and you're saving your energy for the final sprint, right? Well, I didn't know anything about that. So I just hauled ass and got in front of everybody and realized, oh, this isn't over after one loop. And then I, you know, barfed my guts out. You know, I didn't barf, but it was like, I felt horrible after that. And I don't even know, I think I even finished it. I'd exhausted myself. And that's what can happen to you if you binge write one day. If you're a binge writer and you're just one of those guys, you just love writing like fat kid loves cake, then go for it. But just know, if you haven't done that before, it may exhaust you to the point where you don't touch your script for a couple days. Now, sometimes if you get sort of blocked in a particular area of your script, again, write everything else you can. Just leave that little part unwritten. Just put down a footnote of like, this is what kind of should happen in that situation. Go write everything else, and then eventually maybe set the script aside for a week or two and then come back, and you'll be amazed how you read your own writing like it wasn't even yours. One of the other things that I would advise you guys to, just as a little footnote at the end here, when I write fight scenes, unless it's super significant to the fight scene, I don't talk about any of the punches, the kicks, where anything goes. I simply write a paragraph that says, you know, a fight ensues, it's very intense, it's extremely violent, and this character ends up pinning the other person down with a knife on his throat, if that's what I'm writing. Let the stunt coordinators figure out how the fight goes. Don't waste time in your script, because every page is gold, right? The director can say, well, this is a part I can stretch for 10 minutes, or whatever, like the They Live fight in the alleyway. So I think that's about all I got on the basics. I'm going to call this the basics of screenwriting. I really want to inspire you guys to get out there and experiment with this, because again, we don't have enough great writers in the world, and we have so many channels and outlets now. We have to fill up Netflix with something, and Amazon Prime and Apple's new channel and Hulu, as well as HBO and all the studios that exist. They're all dying to find your script, and you need to understand, in 2010, my teacher came up when I probably first took his course in 07, and I took it three more times. The last time I was in his class, I think it was in 2010. He told us, he goes, look, Hollywood spends $750 million a year looking for good scripts. The major studios. This is not all the new spinoffs that have happened in the last 10 years. So if you think that a bunch of great writers exist and their stuff is simply being panned by some crappy reader, it's not true. There's simply nothing out there. If you don't see anything out there, that means nothing came around. So there's a huge demand for this, but there's very few people who have the knowledge to do it and then the passion to do it. And so it's definitely one of these areas that robots are not going to replace for a really long time. And they got some AI programs trying to write movies, but I guarantee you those won't sell very well. Yet most of the AI programmers are like, you know, please make something that makes sense. That'll be what the AI's objective is. Well, it's a bad movie, but it made sense, right? And a program wrote it. You know, it's like, great. You are way more powerful than anything out there because of one major reason, and that is because you are plugged into the universe. And I guess one other piece of advice I would pass on to you guys is be careful watching a bunch of crap all the time. I have friends that are in the film business on a producer side, and they have never taken a writing class, which is why they typically get mystified by crappy scripts, but they go out and make it a rule of them to see every movie that's ever made in the United States, good or bad. They watch everything because they like being at the party, and someone mentions that script and they got all the breakdown of why they thought it was a horrible script or a good script or whatever. The problem is this. To quote something from martial arts, the best fighting styles you can find in the world to work in the real world are fighting styles that have very few moves, but all of them are potentially lethal. You don't want to be negotiating in your mind 1,000 different, you know, MMA moves or karate moves or whatever, Gracie jiu-jitsu moves in a fight that we really is going to, you know, potentially save your life. You want the ones that just go strike, strike, and I'm out of there. I'm running home, you know, whatever. I'm going to a public place to call a cop or something. Same thing with film writing. Surround yourself by the best films that you know that have ever been written and dissect them on the level of where was society when this film came out? Because that is the number one reason why a film became a cult classic. Again, Snow White came out during the Depression. It was a way for everyone, poor as they've ever been, to escape this entire world and go into an animated utopia. Star Wars. You have Vietnam War that just ended and soldiers are coming home all messed up. And this was a way to escape the entire universe, to go out into a galaxy long, far, far away, long, long ago, whatever. And it was awesome. So if those conditions don't exist in society, you may not have the benefit that the cult film had, but at least you will have studied a great piece of art. And that is what you will absorb into your chest, into your mind, into your soul. It will help you write better queries to the universe to find the best stories, to crack those scripts. That's just my personal take on things. I don't surround myself with crap. If you have any other questions about any of this stuff, just put it in the comment section. I'll answer it publicly so everybody gets the benefit of your question. And if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. There's audio, video, locked Facebook group, a Twitter account, two ways to contribute to the page, which is Patreon and PayPal. And really, you know, I wanted to tell you guys, as I struggle to come up with new episodes constantly, what the finances could achieve at some point would be, and really the popularity of a YouTube channel would be the best way to do it, where you don't have to contribute anything. You just pass it around and everyone watches and I get some cash. But the idea is I need to do research for some of these episodes, and that means I don't work. And so that would be probably the best angle as to why that happens. And the guys that make tons of money make great videos because they sit down 8 hours a day researching great, you know, production value. If there's a lot of visuals that need to be put in there, I'm an artist, so I can draw a lot of stuff, but it's hard. When I had to do my episode about World of Warcraft, I had a bunch of loose sketches and I was like, crap, I gotta like somehow crank this out super fast. It's kind of suck. I wish I could have had the time to make things look fantastic. As I talked about my expansion at the end, right? So anyway, just to put a little bit of rationale there. There's a new link to Season 1. I'm on Episode 65 today. Again, we're also on bitchute.com. So I'll let you know when we get all that up. Hopefully this summer, when I take my break after this season's over, I will be able to report that hundreds of episodes are on BitChute and away from the censorship that exists in so many different places. The channel is definitely being shadow banned. A bunch of you are being unsubscribed. And never in the history of a YouTube channel do you get, you know, 10,000 views on a video and no subscribers. But that's what's happening now. So if someone comes on, they're kicking someone off. I mean, something's happening there where it's emptied out. So anyway, take care of yourself and someone else. Write a film, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.